Godwell. Special thanks to Farah Siddiqui, Antonia Gonzalez, Roz Brown, Eric Alatas, Judith Ruiz Branch, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Josh Salem.
And I'm Terrence Burns. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text to KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm joined today by Laura Grimes, Executive Director at Oregon Arts Watch, to talk about some of the latest arts news in our region. Welcome to the show, Laura.
Thanks for having me, Althea.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here. You've brought two stories forward for us today, both of them about the closing of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, or CPB. The first one is from Jim Redden. It's called Corporation for Public Broadcasting Dissolved as Trump's Arts and Culture Cuts Continue. Talk to me about what's happened this past week with CPB.
Very timely news. Both these stories are by Jim Redden. He did both the sort of announcement story and then a follow-up with responses from various stations all over the state. So what happened yesterday was the board of directors of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting voted to dissolve the nonprofit organization. CPB had provided centralized infrastructure and a way to distribute federal funding for public media broadcasting stations like KBOO all over the country for nearly 60 years. So the Trump administration and the Republican-controlled Congress had defunded the organization last summer, so it had already been gutted. And at that time, it pulled back funding that had already been approved and promised to local broadcasting stations. So it left them scurrying to figure out how they were going to make up that budget deficit on short notice. So without any other federal money coming, and knowing that there wasn't going to be, you know, anything else to go on, the CPB board said that they had announced that they voted to dissolve, and in their public statements said that dissolving was the most responsible thing to do rather than, as they put it, be vulnerable to future political manipulation or misuse, threatening the independence of public media. So basically, the board said that by dissolving, it eliminated being exposed to possible legal action or being taken over by hostile parties. And in this way, they are reducing that central threat to the umbrella network and trying to preserve the independence of individual stations all over the country. So really, it's a rather smart and heroic thing to do, as heartbreaking as it might sound. So in Oregon, this decision affects stations all over the state, including KBOO, including OPB, All Classical, Southern Oregon PBS, KWAX Classical Station in Eugene, KRVM in Eugene, and many other stations in smaller towns throughout Oregon. So in those stations in the smaller towns might be hit the hardest because they might not have as much infrastructure and people support to launch fundraising campaigns. They might have relied more on federal dollars, so they have a really big budget gap to make up. And for rural areas, public media is really crucial. It's a lifeline because people might not have access to internet or cell service, and they might rely on radio waves to bring in information and connect them to a wider community. So it's important to understand, you know, just the magnitude of this type of action, because any type of local media like KBOO, you know, like Arts Watch, like any of these other stations affected, provide a really valuable service. You know, they provide local, relevant information. It's not hearsay, it's not gossip, it's intelligent information that has integrity and standards. It's brought by real people in the community. You know, it's not somebody coming in from outside. It hasn't been filtered. It's by real people right here. So this is information that empowers people to make informed decisions. It connects people and helps them to understand one another. It holds institutions accountable. And it can be important public safety information. When there's an emergency, people turn to the news to find out what's going on and to be able to react. You know, it saves lives. So accurate information is power. It affects our everyday life. That's why it's so important. So having said all that, there actually are a few good things that have come out of, I would say, sort of this crisis situation with the defunding of all these stations. Some stations are creatively partnering to share content, which makes them stronger. Many of the bigger stations affected have said that the community has really shown up and contributed financial resources and helped to narrow those funding gaps. So it's really heartening to see that the local community has stepped up, has come together and contributed. They responded to this emergency, but whether that support can be sustained in the long run is the big question.
Well, I'm familiar with how KBOO has been impacted by this. It was a big deal, especially when the funding was first stripped back, and that was about 10-ish percent of our yearly revenue that we were counting on. How does that work for other stations? How much were they relying on CPB funding?
It varied by station, and I'm actually kind of curious to know a little bit more about KBOO's situation. I do know that it is about 10%, and that is kind of the situation for other stations. So it's not like it's not the majority of the budget, but still, you know, 10% is a significant piece, especially when you count on it. You haven't been able to plan for those cutbacks. And one thing that's sort of important to understand, like an economic effect of something, it's not always just about finances. When you have to pivot like that and come up with a whole another plan, you have to spend time. That's your labor cost. You have to spend, you know, your emotional energy figuring all that out. That's the kind of thing that you know, people who are running the stations probably wake up in the middle of the night, you know, wondering how they're going to do. Are they going to have to lay off people? Are they going to have to cut back programming? It's worrisome. So there's the money aspect of it, but there's a bigger burden that it also puts on any type of organization. You know, it is also the labor and the emotional cost as well. So I to answer your question about, you know, how much that is affecting others, like I think OPB was about 10%. I know that but which is relatively small, so it's not like an insurmountable amount that can be made up, but it's still a chunk of budget. So it's hard. And like I mentioned, in the smaller communities, it can be a huge portion of their budget. The federal dollars, you know, they really relied on it because they're not always like really wealthy areas that can depend on other community financial support.
Where does this defunding and dissolution fit into the larger picture of Trump's agenda? What does it mean, basically?
Well, it's basically an attack on, well, media, but also arts and culture of all kinds, any type of information source. It's a way to control how we get information and how we express it, how we receive any type of information. So, you know, he's also affected the National Endowment for the Arts, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the institution for, what is it, Museum and Library Services, which funds museums and libraries all over the country. I mean, it's a full-scale attack on the centralized federal organizations that we all rely on. You know, one thing I had heard too about, you know, CFPB going away that I haven't seen actually addressed in these couple of stories that we published that I think I had heard about elsewhere was that CFPB often took care of the licensing, like for music and the like. So not paying for that as an extra financial burden to individual stations. I'm kind of curious if that is if that affects KABU as well.
My understanding is that there are different groups that allow smaller stations to negotiate kind of as a pack of how they will pay royalties for the songs that they broadcast. And ours is through the National Federation of Community Broadcasters, but that was also related to CPB. So there is some extra negotiating to be done there as well for those stations to figure out how do we make sure that we're out there supporting the artists that are being featured on our stations. There's definitely a lot of added complication to what stations are facing.
And again, that speaks to the whole added burden. There's sort of a weakening of the systems that happen because, you know, it's time that you're not able to pay toward, you know, making connections in your community and building up your programming and doing things that strengthen the organization. You know, it's a distraction, so which is unfortunate.
Well, your reporter Jim Redden also wrote about how public media leaders in Oregon reacted to the decision in a separate piece. What sticks out to you about these reactions?
Yeah, I really appreciated how they mentioned all the benefits of public media, how, you know, it is reliable information that focuses on education, it focuses on arts and culture, and in the many ways that we live our lives, you know, that provides that. So I thought, you know, a lot of the comments from, I think he talked to maybe a half dozen leaders of stations around the state. And I thought that some of them expressed sadness, but also how they were heartened, how the community had really shown up for them. And so that was hopeful, I guess, and how, you know, now what they really have to turn to is working on how to sustain that increased community support in the long term. That was really sort of a message that I took away, that they're having to adapt, but they are adapting really well. They are, you know, fairly strong. They're continuing to work on their fundraising efforts. But and like I mentioned, that some of them have had to creatively partner, which is not necessarily a bad thing. That's great because it strengthens the community for everybody. But I think there is the big question of what it's going to look like in a few years. You know, are donors going to become fatigued? Are you know, is there that feeling that they need to immediately respond to the situation? Is that going to go away? So, but it could be that they come out stronger, you know, that it's really genuinely community supported, you know, local stations supported by local people. So it could be that it makes for better stations. Who knows? I think there's a big question about that in the future.
Well, it is the start of a new year, just to switch gears a little bit. Are there art stories that you'll be watching for in the coming months that our listeners should maybe be aware of?
Oh, all kinds of stuff. It's sort of one of the big things that we are turning our attention to is that it's the 250th anniversary of the birth of our nation. And so there's a lot of focus on history and different types of storytelling. And so we have beefed up our coverage of historical events and what's happening around the nation, around the state, I should say, because we're really focused on Oregon. So that's something that to pay attention to. We're already starting to make a list. We have sort of a plan in place of how to tackle that. So that's going to be sort of interesting. And what I'm kind of excited about for Oregon is that they really want the full picture of everybody's experiences to to be displayed. You know, they really, it's not just going to be, you know, sort of a whitewashed version of history. I think they really would like it from many different communities, and that's what the Oregon Commission for the America 250 Oregon Project is focusing on, and I think that is a really great priority. So that's what we're going to be paying attention to, at least I guess for the next year.
If our listeners are interested in reading the stories that we talked about, keeping up with Oregon Arts Watch, what's the best way for them to do that?
You can read about all of these stories and more at Oregon Arts Watch at orartswatch.org.
Well, thank you so much, Laura. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us.
Thanks for having me, Althea. It's always a pleasure to visit.
That was Laura Grimes, Executive Director at Oregon Arts Watch, speaking with me about some of the latest arts news in our region. More information is online at orartswatch.org. For KABU News in Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
KABU News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KABU News in Depth. I'm Carmel Pierre-Louis. President Trump has focused his anger on Somalis and Somalia. In his first administration, he referred to the country with expletives and tried to prevent Somalis from coming to the U.S. Independent photojournalist David Bankin has documented Somali life in the U.S. KABU contributor David Rosenberg spoke with him about Trump's hatred and fear of Somali people.
So Trump and Somalis, what's going on there? Why does he hate them or fear them? Is it just sort of more of his typical rhetoric, just picking on a group and saying, I'm going to go after them and hope it resonates with my base? What's happening there?
Well, Trump has been singling out Somalis since his first administration. And I think in part that's because he has been singling out Ilhan Omar, who is probably, I think, the most progressive member of Congress and is herself Somali from Minneapolis. So I think he doesn't like her politics, but Trump also goes after Black women. And Ilhan Omar is one of the most well-known African-American and African women in the country. And so he's going after her for that reason as well, too. But I think that what it really shows is a lot of fear, because one of the significant things about the Somali community in the United States is that it is a very politically engaged community. Minnesota now has 3 members of its legislature who were born in Somalia, in addition to Ilhan Omar as a member of Congress. Well, when you look at the size of the Somali community in Minnesota, 43,000 people in a state of 5.8 million people. So it's very clear that Somali political leaders are being elected to office with the votes that go far beyond the Somali community itself. And in the state of Maine, it's even more clear. Minnesota and Maine are the two states where Somali people have settled most in the U.S. And in Maine, there are three members of the state legislature who come from Somalia or Somalis. And again, there are only 6,000 Somalis in the state of Maine, in a state of 1.4 million people, which is often called the whitest state in the United States. So it's very clear that white voters are voting for African and African-American political leaders. First of all, I think what it shows is that Trump's assumption that white people are going to vote on the basis of race and in a racist way is not true, clearly, in these cases. And also because those political leaders, the Somalis, are advocating things that are very much the demands of working people in the state of Maine. You know, one of the political leaders in Maine is a member of their Congress, Dika Dalak, and she ran for office on a campaign platform of climate change. She represents a part of the city of Portland, South Portland, which is on the coast of Maine. So climate change is very important for a city that is on the coast, especially one that has a big fishing industry, as well as affordable housing. And she also promotes DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion. So here you have voters who are not just voting for her as a person, but also voting for that as part of her political program. And I think that that's what Trump is really afraid of more than anything else.
Given all that, do you think he's going to get some advantage out of this attack with his MAGA base, or is he just sort of unhinged and doesn't know what he's doing?
Well, I think that Trump is making assumptions about white people in the United States. I think he's making assumptions that white people are in his MAGA base, and all he has to do is throw insults at people of color, especially immigrants, especially Black people, and that's going to make him popular. And while there might be part of that MAGA base that goes for that, I think it's very clear that there is a big section of the population that is rejecting it. And that is a multiracial section of the population of people of color, of immigrants, of women, and of white people, of working people. So I think that Trump's assumptions, easy assumptions, racist assumptions are very hollow.
Anyone else in the Trump administration echoing him on that issue, or any pushback from anyone around him? Or are they kind of with him on that?
No, you know, the Trump administration is, you know, it runs on the basis of you have to agree and praise Trump in order to stay in office. So, you know, when he was making his insults in a cabinet meeting, the vice president, Vance, was pounding the table saying, right on. And immediately, he also got a statement of support from his immigration czar, Tom Homan, who said, well, you know, immigrants are a problem, you know, and immigrants in Somalia or Somali immigrants in Maine and Minneapolis are a problem. So he's sort of stepping into line, you know, supporting Trump as well, too. But I think that's because the Trump administration consists of people who are willing to kiss his you-know-what.
Are people in the administration talking about, I forget what it's called, remigration, or this idea that they're going to deport people who are American citizens just because their ethnic origins are from somewhere else?
Trump legally cannot deport American citizens. He is threatening to denationalize, but the process for denationalizing, in other words, for taking somebody who's become a citizen and taking away their citizenship, is a very, very restricted process. So now clearly Trump is trying to abolish the protections that are written into law and into the Constitution. I'm sure has hopes, and Stephen Miller as well has hopes of making it much easier to denationalize or denaturalize somebody, in other words, take away their citizenship. And that would obviously affect Somalis, because the Somalis who are citizens are either the children of people who have come here, you know, some time ago, or are mostly people who have been naturalized and who have become citizens since they got here. So that would affect them. But of course, it's way, 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 way beyond Somalis. I mean, what he's threatening to do is basically starting to go after people who are citizens across the board. and find some way of driving them out of the country and taking away their citizenship. I think that's going to be very difficult.
He's also attacked Somalia, as you point out, as one of those so-called whole countries. What's going on there? Is that an attack on Africa? I mean, you've got AFRICOM over there trying to militarize the continent. Is he trying to somehow upset what the U.S. has got going on there?
Well, in his first administration, Trump did call a group of countries by an epithet that I didn't think we were allowed to use on the radio.
Yeah, I'll have to delete that.
So we'll have to bleep it out.
Yeah.
You know, in some ways, that's, again, it just reflects his racism, because these were all countries in Africa and the Middle East, as well as North Korea. So in other words, non-white countries, non-European countries. But also, this was part of his effort to stop migration from those countries. And he did that, or he tried to do that in his first administration. Eventually, there were court decisions that went against him, and then in the end, kind of for him. But in the process, also what it did was it inspired a wave of resistance. When he announced that the people from those countries would not be able to come into the country, there were people who were stuck in airports, and all over the country, people went out to the airports. I remember here in the Bay Area, hundreds of people went out to the San Francisco airport and shut down the airport, and were able to free those people who were being essentially held in detention because they had arrived in the country when Trump made his declaration. And now he's trying to do it again. He has another group of 16 countries this time that he's going to stop anybody from those countries from coming to the United States at all. So this is, you know, again, part of his constant effort. But I think it's also something that we have fought before. And I think, in fact, I'm sure that we are going to fight it again.
Is he going after Somalis saying they are a criminal element, as he has with some other groups?
Well, there is no record of criminality among Somalis who are here. There were other statements, you know, that are, you know, the same kind of rhetoric. You know, yes, they commit crimes, they're on welfare, they collect money, they're this and that. You know, in other words, trying to demonize them as people. But clearly, this is not something that the voting population of those communities supports, because they are electing Somalis to office. And so, you know, a community that had a record of this kind of, well, you know, these insulting record that Trump is attributing to them would not be, well, people would not be willing to vote for them in the way that they are. So I think that the support that the Somalis are getting from their surrounding community is the best refutation of these ridiculous, you know, accusations that Trump and his minions are making against them.
So it sounds like what Trump is doing, it could really backfire even among his own base, would you think?
Well, I think it is going to, in the long run, backfire. You know, the racism in this country does run deep. There's no question about that. And so Trump is assuming that he can appeal to that and have that appeal be one that's going to be supported by a vast number of people. I think the drop in his poll numbers, you know, the counter demonstrations against ICE all over the country, not just in places like, you know, Los Angeles and Washington, D.C., but even in the South, in Charlotte, North Carolina, in the Hill Country of North Carolina, in New Orleans, there are counter demonstrations against, you know, these sort of ICE and Border Patrol terror campaign. I think that these things are turning people against Trump, really, even though he thinks that this is something that he can use to sort of whip up his base.
That was independent photojournalist David Bacon speaking with KABU contributor David Rosenberg. For KABU News and Death, I'm Carmel Pierre-Louis.
KBOO Portland.
KBOO's zine, The Boo Beat, is back with a second issue, featuring KBOO's program guide, interviews with local activists and community members, spotlights on local businesses, on-the-ground reporting, and fun quizzes and crosswords. Our zine has its finger on the pulse of Portland.